I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from COP28 host the UAE, which at the UN Security Council has forced the issue of a ceasefire amidst the UK-US-EU nation-backed alleged Gaza genocide. While thousands have been killed in Gaza and near Jerusalem, hundreds of thousands may be killed through excess deaths in Europe this winter. Energy is arguably key then in Gaza at COP28 and the OPEC Plus meeting, where GCC countries, plus Russia, Iran, Venezuela and others, have so far refused NATO nation calls to pump more oil. Joining me now from one of the world's biggest carbon emitter cities, New York City, is Abhi Rajendran, the head of global oil markets and research at Energy Intelligence and adjunct research scholar at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy. Abhi, thanks so much for coming back on. So we've had Nord Stream, we've had Saudi Arabia refusing to pump more oil along with OPEC Plus members. And presumably markets already realise that the numbers killed in winter in Western Europe won't be even more than in... Well, it will be more, but it won't be even more than in Gaza.
Yeah, first, thanks for having me. Certainly a lot going on in the world of energy, between oil and gas markets and of course, geopolitics kind of stuck in between all of it. We're also, kind of going through this roller coaster, within the year, where we've had a pretty hot summer, not just temperature wise, but in terms of demand and consumption. Things are kind of cooling off as they typically do at this time of the year. But a lot of uncertainty, looking to the end of the year and ahead to 2024, for sure.
But yet there's no increase in oil prices.
Yeah, I mean, look, in November seasonally is always, is typically the not always, but typically the worst month for oil prices. So in some sense, this is not surprising.
Depending on who you are, of course.
Depending on who you are, yeah.
The best month
The absolute oil price, yeah. It's always a tough month to get the price to go up. It's typically a month where the price goes down, and there's always some drama, with not always, but usually some drama with OPEC Plus heading into Thanksgiving weekend. So there's that as well.
But all those countries that didn't want a ceasefire, clearly confident that there wasn't going to be a wider conflagration that would affect oil prices. I mean, they were confidently saying, we don't want a ceasefire, all these children are dying, it's fine, they're all being killed. In terms of its effect, boomerang impact on the economies of Western Europe and the United States.
Yeah, I mean, look, the conflict and the situation is obviously pretty dire and tragic in many ways. Since the early days, after October 7th, what we were looking for is what you just mentioned, which is the possibility of an expansion of the conflict, pulling in other countries, pulling in Hezbollah from the north, pulling in Iran in particular directly into the conflict. Both with Israel, but also kind of related to some of the other countries in the region. That never happened, right? And I think as every week went by, it was increasingly clear that Iran, while it may have been indirectly involved in sparking the conflict, directly did not want to get involved, and even with Hezbollah and others, that never really got worse. And even the U.S. and other kind of Israel allies were pretty keen on keeping Iran in particular out of it. And so from a supply standpoint, we haven't really seen much of a disruption. There was obviously that kind of that initial concern and worry and spike in oil prices. That all kind of quickly evaporated, and then we're kind of back down to to typical November seasonality.
So it was a big fact. I mean, obviously the conflict began decades ago in the 1940s, but it was clearly that Iran, which denied any involvement in October 7th, said they could be a big impact. I mean, I saw senior Israeli officials were quoted as saying Israel wants the USA to diplomatically work to pressure Hezbollah to withdraw its troops from the Al-Radwan unit on the outskirts of the Golan Heights. Clearly the United States, I don't know what connections they have with Hezbollah, but clearly Iran was the big energy factor here.
Yeah, that's right. Iran was the big energy factor. I think everybody was, it seemed like every side, kind of wanted to stay out of it and not really get involved in kind of escalating the crisis. And that, and that took the air out of oil prices. It kind of calmed the market down, even just kind of from a, you know, from the standpoint of equity markets and other markets that were a little bit, you know, uneasy about the conflict in the beginning. But, you know, everything just kind of calmed down. And obviously it's not, you know, sort of de-escalated in any way, but it has not, you know, kind of become a broader regional issue, which is what we were looking for to see if there was actually going to be a supply impact.
But if it hasn't had an impact directly on the graphs of Brent and NYMEX, over the dead bodies of these thousands of children, Biden sent his energy security advisor Amos Hochstein to Israel while all this was happening. I mean, in one way, I've got to ask why the United States doesn't want higher oil prices, because it is a net exporter. But in another way, what on earth was he doing there, and why were the Israeli papers talking about tons of gas in Gaza while we were watching the pictures of all these murdered children?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think there are both oil and gas, kind of issues at play. I think from the, you know, from the U.S. standpoint, the focus, has been on two key things. One is not letting the situation escalate and finding, sort of off ramps, finding some, some middle grounds where hostages and other things could be negotiated. That's
you mean, you know, not I mean, obviously it's escalated because every day hundreds more children were being killed. You mean not escalate geographically? It was contained within the 2 million people living in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Right. And also try to find a way to kind of come up with, with some ways to address the civilian casualty situation, address the hostage situation, to find some middle ground from all sides. And I think the second point is directly, tied to energy. Right. I mean, I think this administration is hypersensitive about energy prices.
Because of the presidential election, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. It's holiday season. A lot of folks are traveling. It's kind of an important, time of the year. So there's that. And then, of course, looking ahead to 2024, right? We don't want this to turn into a big, broader regional issue. And then you have 100, 110 type of dollar oil prices like you had last year, when the Russia-Ukraine conflict first broke out. So definitely wanting to avoid that. Now, what's interesting is on the oil side, you never really had a supply disruption. On the natural gas side, you did, right? Israel shut down the Tamar field. That had a knock-on effect to Egypt and other areas. That was another thing that's kind of been partially reversed in recent weeks. That was also part of the discussion. Part of the focus.
Just remind us where this LNG comes from. It passes through Israel, and they shut it down after October 7th to Egypt.
That's right. So the gas is an offshore field off of Israel. Some of that gas passes into Israel. Some of it actually goes into Egypt, which gets re-exported out of Egypt. Some of it gets consumed domestically in Egypt, and some of it gets re-exported out. And so that was shut down for a couple of weeks, and is now back on. So that was also part of it.
Why does Egypt need the LNG off of the coast of Palestine or Israel, or the occupied territories? Can't it get it elsewhere? Why is it collaborating so closely with a government that on paper they say they disagree with the alleged Gaza genocide about?
Yeah, I mean, one, they can't really get it anywhere else. Two, yeah, I mean, this was a project that was kind of, co-developed and co-commercialized, and then Egypt was an outlet for that gas. That gas getting developed, Egypt was kind of an outlet for getting that gas a home, through LNG exports to Europe and other sources. So that was kind of a commercial business decision that came about over many years. And we'll kind of see. We'll see, to your point. Obviously there's kind of this big pushback against the civilian situation in Gaza. We'll see what the future of that relationship looks like.
Yeah, it seems strange to be talking about oil revenues, future revenues, which was reported in Israeli press from energy resources, given there are people probably dying tonight, children dying tonight because of the cold in Gaza who can't heat their homes. What exactly is the extent of energy reserves in this area where people can't heat themselves tonight? We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars worth, billions of dollars worth of gas from Gaza?
I mean, you know, from a reserve, pure reserve standpoint, there are billions of dollars of gas there. I think the likelihood of it, but anytime soon, getting commercialized, right? You know, you kind of have to go through the process of bringing in, operators who'd be interested in developing these resources. You know, figuring out, the partnerships, the revenue sharing with, local government and things like that. All of that, seems like, very, very distant. Type of potential situation.
I mean,
From a
BP's lease
producer,
runs out. I saw reports about BP's lease on exploration rights, I understand.
yeah, so they run out. I mean, that's the thing, right? I think the producers, the operators, need to kind of see political stability. They need to, see, kind of a security situation that's stable. They're not, obviously now things are, quite messy, but they're not likely to kind of
But
change
then,
their tune on this
why was this guy being sent there then, Amos Hochstein? I mean, he worked in Texas gas markets. You'd expect proper diplomats to be visiting Israel to discuss the alleged genocide, not oil people, the main energy advisor to the Biden administration, being sent amidst all the killing. What was he there for then?
Well, I mean, he's been, Amos has been a diplomat that, has gotten quite a few deep relationships in the region. He's been to the region and worked there many times under this administration over the last couple of years, and even kind of predating this administration. He's been there. He's got kind of a relationship. Forget about Israel, but he's spent a significant amount of time in Saudi Arabia. To your point, in the Emirates and in other parts. So so leveraging those relationships. And again, trying to I think it's less about energy and more about trying to find some off ramps here to the situation, is his role. And of course, there's an energy piece to it as well. Given that the disruptions have been quite minor, I think it's really kind of more on the security, and stability side. So yeah, I mean, from an American standpoint, sending Amos there, kind of makes sense. And given that, energy is pretty, tied into this whole situation in the region, having some of that expertise does help.
Abhi Rajendran, and I'll stop you there. More from the head of global oil markets and research at Energy Intelligence after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the head of global oil markets and research at Energy Intelligence, Abhi Rajendran. Abhi, we were talking about the conflict getting bigger, and that might affect energy prices, which it hasn't so far. Does that mean that, given in the Lebanese context, we've heard Iran say, well, it's up to Lebanon what it wants to do? The control of energy markets, in a sense, across the world depends on what happens in South Lebanon.
Yeah, you know, we do, you know, we talked about this briefly before. I think that is, you know, sort of your spark to a, you know, potentially bigger conflict, right? And I think obviously from, you know, US or Israel or, you know, allied side, they don't want that, but it doesn't really seem like the, you know, the Hezbollah and, you know, kind of the, you know, indirectly through Iran side really wants that either. You know, we've been watching this closely for you know, for, you know, nearly 2 months now. It doesn't really seem like there's any sort of, you know, imminent, you know, mobilization to a bigger threat.
Now, the Biden administration certainly hasn't been happy about previous OPEC Plus meetings, Antony Blinken being sent to beg Saudi Arabia to increase production and so on. We had expected the OPEC Plus meeting this week. What do you think's behind the postponing of such an important, such a critical OPEC Plus meeting, albeit around the time of COP28 as well here in Dubai?
Yeah, interesting timing. The meeting, you know, getting delayed to the start date of COP28. So that's obviously going to be a interesting clash of messages. But you know,
Well,
for
in fairness,
OPEC
Abby, surely cutting production's good for the environment.
Plus, well, and but also has issues. You know, has a knock-on effect on prices and inflation, and you know, and investment in that new energy too, right? So it does cut both ways. You know, I think with OPEC Plus, look, I think they have, you know, sort of two key, you know, messy issues to work through. The first is that, you know, Saudi Arabia has kind of taken the burden of cutting on behalf of the group, you know, disproportionately. While that has happened, you know, you've had one, you know, some pretty unreliable compliance from Russia, which is the, you know, the other big country that matters. You've had a big ramp up in production from Iran, and you've had, you know, it's kind of a slow, steady ramp up from, you know,
Where do
production
you,
from other
Abby, when
countries
you're
like Libya
analyzing
and
all this,
Algeria.
where do you get the figures from? Because, as you imply there's a grey market now for oil ever since the self-sanctioning of European governments and the sanctioning in the United States. Have you ever seen statistics in such a malaise as they are right now when it comes to oil production, oil transportation, oil services generally, given no one seems to know who's selling, who's buying, and what price they're buying and selling at?
Yeah, so I mean, we are, you know, we are one, an official secondary source of OPEC at Energy Intelligence. You know, you know, we've got, you know, over 100 folks who are boots on the ground who talk to traders, shippers, other folks who are in the oil industry, you know, from end to end. And so we try to, you know, kind of piece together a lot of this story ourselves and get our own
But
kind of
wait, in
information.
secret meetings by the dockside. Because they can't say it,
No,
can
I
they,
mean
in
we've got,
public?
you know, we've got our sources, right? I mean, we've got folks on the dockside that we can pick up the phone and call. We've got folks, you know, on the ships that we can pick up the phone and call. We've got folks, you know, who are signing the papers for, you know, for these sanctions and price caps and things like that, who are contact. So my colleagues, you know, do a, you know, a great job, you know, kind of digging up as much information as they can, right? I mean, as you mentioned, there is a gray market. There is some, you know, opacity in the information, but we try to kind of piece it together as much as we can. You know, we produce monthly stats on every country's production, exports, you know, including, you know, what we see as, you know, kind of gray market, you know, black market type of volumes. So we try to account for all of that, you know, into our intelligence, right? Into our, you know, kind of our bigger picture look at what's going on in oil markets in terms of supply, demand, prices, and whatnot. And this is actually, and we feed this into OPEC itself. It's one of the inputs that they use when they go into big decisions like this. And, you know, I think from what they're seeing, it's kind of in line with what we're seeing, is that there's a lot of, you know, kind of, you know, choppy compliance. There's a lot of, you know, countries that are, you know, ramping up production. You know, there's some cheating here and there, and that's, you know, part of the delay.
So there's going to have to be some official production cuts announced at the next OPEC Plus meeting, given this environment.
I would say, you know, our expectation is, you know, nothing of, you know, no official. I mean, we have official production cuts now. I think we were going to have to, one, see a better focus on compliance, you know, kind of reining in some of those producers that have, you know, that have been, you know, kind of leaking volumes as Saudi Arabia has taken away volumes back into the market. And I think the second piece is, which I didn't mention, was you know, some of the smaller OPEC Plus countries are pushing back on their production quotas. They're saying it's too low, it needs to be higher. That's another piece. You know, again, these are smaller member states, not the big ones. That's another thing that needs to be addressed at this meeting. But, you know, this meeting really is about, you know, Saudi Arabia taking the, you know, the burden of this production cuts, having to kind of rein in some of these producers that are, you know, kind of doing their own thing, you know, otherwise, you know, sort of threatening that, you know, that they're going to unwind their cuts and then everybody loses with lower prices as a result.
Because Saudi Arabia very vocal about calling for an arms embargo against Israel. And of course, the amount of military weaponry and so on in the Eastern Mediterranean using vital energy resources must have some kind of impact, doesn't it? The largest armadas in history, one of them Biden has sent to the Eastern Mediterranean. All these warplanes, aircraft carriers, military equipment sent there and to the South China Sea. Isn't that affecting energy prices at all?
I think the answer to your question is not really, basically not at all. I think the, obviously, you know, there is this, you know, there is this big, you know, kind of pushback against, you know, the Israeli response and the situation in Gaza. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of, you know, kind of back channeling going on, you know, within the, you know, the Arab world. But also, you know, kind of, you know, maybe through Qatar and other sources, you know, between, you know, the West and countries like Saudi Arabia in particular on how to sort of prevent the situation from getting worse and then finding off ramps to, you know, to maybe, you know, and again, you know, it's unlikely that, you know, some permanent ceasefire is going to happen anytime soon. But, you know, but at least we have some, you know, some temporary ones that are taking shape now. To sort out hostages and things like that. So I, you know, I think, yes, sure. You know, there's a question of, you know, arming Israel and things like that, but more broadly, I think the concern is about containing the situation and not letting it get, you know, into a bigger regional conflict.
I think many people might have been surprised by how quickly the, after Biden said Nord Stream would end and stop, and of course, it was destroyed, allegedly, by the Biden administration. We saw LNG terminals start popping up in Western Europe so quickly. We know hundreds of thousands of people, poor people, die in Western Europe in terms of excess deaths. Do you think the United States will be filling in that gap on LNG to stabilize prices this winter for Western Europe?
Yeah, I mean, the United States has been the number one kind of stopgap for missing gas volumes for Europe, you know, over the last couple of years, actually even predating the Russia-Ukraine situation. Europe had a gas crisis back in 2021. So this was
is
not
fracked
even
gas, right? From Texas.
Correct,
and
yeah,
so on,
yeah,
in violation of what COP28 talks about.
Yeah, you know, for the most part, shale gas, yeah, for you know, fracked shale gas, but you know, that this is what Europe needs, and despite, you know, some of the kind of gaps being filled from the U.S. and, you know, maybe from Qatar and other sources, you know, Europe more broadly, but certainly in particular in countries like Germany, continues to deindustrialize, right? They have. Massive issues in, you know, in key industries like chemicals, agriculture, fertilizers, and other areas, because even with, you know, some of the gas gaps being filled, they are short of energy, or they're finding energy that's too expensive.
That's clearly not what the Scholz government says. They say they're doing fine, their coalition, and the sanctions was a great policy after the Ukraine conflict, now winding down, arguably.
Yeah, the Scholz government is not a very popular government these days, so I'll just let the German people, you know, make a decision on that one.
So you're saying that things are going to be really tough then on Western Europe, given the decisions they've been making, unless they change their sanctions policy then?
Yeah, things are going to be tough. I mean, you know, as always, you know, especially in you know, winter seasons, it kind of depends on how cold the winter is. You know, Europe, you know, kind of got off with a relatively easy winter last year, but that's, you know, every year could be different. This year we've had, you know, El Nino, La Nina, and all kinds of other, you know, kind of extreme weather effects, you know, that can kind of change things. So you know, Europe, you know, is still, you know, kind of in an uncertain place. Yes, they have basically full gas reserves, right, or gas inventories, but you know how that looks In a couple of months, in March, April, will be a key data point to watch.
So if it's a very severe winter, can your organization estimate how much the sanctions are having in terms of effect? How many people are being killed effectively in Western Europe by the sanctions if there's a severe winter?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty tough number to come by. If Europe has a cold winter this winter, I think they'll be okay because they do have, inventories that are over and beyond even, normal winter levels. So I think this winter they'll be okay. I think the question then becomes if they have to draw down those inventories again, into the spring months, what impact does that have for them next year? Again, they'll have to go back and buy expensive gas, expensive LNG imports, keep those manufacturing and other sectors muted, and not allow the demand to come back too much to be able to maintain enough supply.
And just finally, the expansion of EV electrical vehicles. We expect massive mining expansion of minerals that help to power the batteries of all these electrical vehicles in the global south, in Africa, in Latin America, and so on.
So two things are happening in the kind of the EV kind of electrification world. I think one, you're kind of seeing a little bit of an adjustment process in the adoption curve for EVs. In our review, China is doing better than expected. Europe is doing about as well as expected in terms of its EV adoption. But the biggest car market in the world, the US, is going much slower than many expected. So there's a lot of, moving parts in the electric world. And because of that, a lot of, prices for some of these metals and minerals and other materials that you mentioned have come down quite a bit. Lithium, graphite, cobalt and other things. There's kind of this realignment going on the demand and supply side. Yes, you will need a lot more mining. You're going to need a lot more extraction and processing, for batteries and other inputs into EVs over the next, decade and beyond. As these prices come down, that has an effect on the timing of supply. Things get pushed out, delayed, but it also has an effect on maybe, spurring demand a little bit because prices are lower, cars are cheaper than they were, a year or 2 years ago. So we're going to kind of see this cat and mouse play out over the next several years. I think, I think we're finding generally that, EV adoption curves are going about as well as we expected, but, overall, but slower than many did. We've kind of addressed some of the low-hanging fruit. But once you kind of get into mass adoption, that gets harder just because of all the kind of the consumer preferences and other things that you have to work through. So that's kind of where we are with EVs. Will be a key thing to watch over the next couple of years.
Abhi Rajendran, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday to talk to the US government's former chief economist at the Department of Agriculture, Joseph Glober, about why hundreds of millions are still facing a food crisis in a world full of food. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.